with rising tensions between Iran and the U.S., President Trump announced a new round of sanctions on the country last week. Sanctions have been called the tool of choice for policymakers to respond to international incidents without using military force and when diplomacy has failed. And today we're going to take a closer look at their history and whether they actually work. Daniel Dresner is a professor of international politics at Tufts University. He's also the author of the book, The Sanctions Paradox, Economic Statecraft and International Relations. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
So where did the idea of sanctions originally come from?
Oh, goodness. Well, you can argue that the first sanction actually is recorded in the history of the Peloponnesian War at the beginning. There was an Athenian boycott of a small city-state named Megara that many historians believe was one of the triggers, in fact, for the Peloponnesian War.
Well, bringing it up to modern times, when were sanctions first used in maybe in an effective way in the modern era?
Yeah, I was going to say, because they do have a long history of being used in an ineffective way. You could probably argue that the most successful use of sanctions, and one that sort of sets the stage for the U.S. use of it, was when the Eisenhower administration threatened to let the pound essentially, they blocked the United Kingdom from withdrawing its IMF quotas in 1956 when the United Kingdom, France, and Israel intervened in the Suez Crisis. There was immediate pressure put on the pound. The Eisenhower administration, by using its veto power to prevent Britain from withdrawing some of its IMF quota to defend the pound, made it clear that it disagreed. There was a run on the pound, at which point Britain, France, and Israel complied with the U.S. request.
And there are sanctions that can be put in place by multinational organizations like the United Nations, but also individual nations, as you just said, for instance, the United States. How do those processes work, whether it's an individual country or a larger body?
Well, it varies from country to country, obviously. In the case of international organizations, you know, the primary promulgator of sanctions tends to be the UN Security Council, although on occasion the UN General Assembly has gotten involved. And there are instances in which other international bodies have applied sanctions on specific issues, like the CITES, C-I-T-E-S, which is the international body dealing with endangered species, will occasionally apply sanctions on countries suspected not to be enforcing those provisions. With the United States, in particular, sanctions can come from a variety of sources. The most obvious being Congress. Congress can certainly pass a law mandating sanctions against a particular country or category of countries that have engaged in bad behavior. The president, however, has considerable latitude to be able to employ sanctions, as we obviously have seen in recent years, primarily through a statute called IEEPA, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, which was passed in the 1970s and indeed is a source of great controversy because it is one of the ways in which Donald Trump has been used it to declare emergencies to do a variety of things.
And if the U.S. president does impose sanctions, does Congress have any oversight of that?
Congress can, in theory, try to override it. The problem is twofold, actually. The first is that in order to be able to override it, they would need to have a veto-proof coalition, which is extremely unlikely in this kind of polarized climate. But the second problem is that, by and large, Congress's issue with sanctions has not been imposing them. It's been lifting them. There are an awful lot of sanctions laws on the books in which even if the target country has potentially complied or at least taken steps to comply, Congress has generally refused to lift the sanctions or wound up imposing new ones.
And we use the term sanctions as shorthand, but really there are several different types of sanctions, right?
That's correct. The sort of traditional sanctions, and this goes back to the Embargo Act of 1808, which Thomas Jefferson passed, is trade sanctions, the idea that you will either raise tariffs or prohibit trade in certain categories of goods designed to punish the country. More recently, you're seeing the implementation of financial sanctions and aid sanctions, where the goal is to disrupt a country's financial relationship or connection to global capital markets. Furthermore, you're also seeing the development of sanctions where the target is not necessarily the country writ large, but rather individuals or entities within that country. So, for example, when President Trump announced that he was designating the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps as a terrorist actor, the idea was that that way the IRGC would be the subject of sanctions.
We're talking with Dan Dresner right now. He's a professor of international politics at Tufts University. He's also the author of the book, The Sanctions Paradox, Economic Statecraft and International Relations. And we're talking about different types of sanctions and whether they're effective. And Dan, looking at real data and outcomes, in your opinion, do sanctions work?
Well, I'm an academic, so I'm required by law to say that the answer is it depends. Sanctions have undeniably achieved some significant accomplishments. As I said, the Suez crisis would certainly be one. There are others, such as the degree to which sanctions caused Iran to sign a nuclear deal in 2015. Their overall track record is not great. The estimates range from, about 20% to 40% in terms of success. But there are a variety of factors. They're more likely to work under certain circumstances than others. If you have multilateral support, that increases the odds of success. If the target is not an adversary, but rather an ally of the country that's sanctioning it, that increases the odds for success. Generally speaking, if the target is a democracy, it's thought to increase the odds that they will work. And also, and this might be really, really banal, but it's important, if the demands that the sanctioning country are putting on the sanctioned are reasonable and modest, they're much more likely to work. Sometimes if the demands are even if the sanctions are incredibly punishing, if the demands are incredibly grandiose, then you're not going to get any concessions.
It seems like it would be difficult to really judge how effective sanctions were in a particular case because they're not happening in a vacuum. There are all kinds of things happening in any country all the time. So how do you even kind of tease out the impact of the sanctions specifically?
Well, there's a couple of ways you can do that. One obviously is in terms of whether they work or they succeed or not, is whether or not the target actually changes its behavior in a manner consistent with what the sanctioning country has demanded. In terms of their economic effects, one study that I did as part of a Center for New American Security task force report was to examine countries that were sanctioned with countries that were similar in terms of their economic profile. So, for example, comparing Iran, which was under sanctions at the time, with other oil exporters, like, let's say, Saudi Arabia or Iraq, to see whether those countries also suffered or were affected in any way by larger macroeconomic factors during the same time.
It also seems like there are always difficulties in gauging preventive measures. Is it maybe the case sometimes that there aren't significant results from the sanctions, but had the sanctions not been put into place, the situation might have been exponentially worse?
That's absolutely correct. And indeed, you actually highlight another possible effect of sanctions, which is even harder to assess, which is the deterrent effect, which is it might be the case that the sanctions don't necessarily cause the targeted country to change their behavior, but the impact of the sanctions might convince other countries contemplating similar actions not to do those things. So this is the justification that many have put forward for, let's say, the sanctions against Russia after Russia seized Crimea, which was Russia was never going to give up Crimea. Asking a country to give up territory is one of the biggest asks in world politics. That said, the sanctions were sufficiently punishing so that other countries that might have contemplated territorial land grabs also might have thought twice about it. Of course, trying to puzzle out or tease out whether this is actually what's going on is phenomenally difficult, and it's obviously subject to significant academic debate.
We're talking about leaders of countries, governments. Often there's a lot of posturing going on. Let's look at the person or the country who is imposing sanctions. Is it sometimes used as a way to telegraph to their own constituents, look, I'm doing something, we're trying to address this issue?
Absolutely. Sanctions are very often viewed as the perfect way of demonstrating that you're doing something without necessarily doing something even riskier, like, let's say, the use of force. This is one of the reasons, by the way, that Congress is particularly enamored of sanctions, because sanctions are simultaneously a symbol that you can show to your voters that you actually care about foreign policy without it being so high risk that there would actually be significant consequences on, let's say, your target district.
And on the other side, can the impact of sanctions be an excuse for the government of a targeted country to use for why people's lives are difficult, that it's not their actions, it's because of the sanctions?
You just explained what Cuba has done since about 1961, with the brief exception of when the Obama administration partially lifted some of the Cuba sanctions. But yes, Cuba is a great example of this. They have consistently blamed their woeful economic performance not on their centrally planned economy, but rather on the U.S. sanctions against the Castro regime and the communist regime.
And Dan, as we wrap up, there are some critics of economic sanctions who say that they hurt innocent people in the country more than anyone else. Is that a valid point?
I think it is a valid point. There have been sanctions in the past that have been without question devastating from a humanitarian perspective. The post-Gulf War sanctions on Saddam Hussein's Iraq would be a good example of this. One of the, theoretically, the financial sanctions that we've talked about should spare other countries a little bit more, because essentially those the people that are hurt the most from those kinds of targeted sanctions are, frankly, the people that have money in the first place. But to be honest, an awful lot of research into the effect of those sanctions suggests that they also have implications, negative implications, on targeted populations as well. So this is a debate that is ongoing.
Well, Dan, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Happy to talk.
That was Daniel Dresner, professor of international politics at Tufts University and the author of the book The Sanctions Paradox, Economic Statecraft and International Relations. He was with us to break down how sanctions work and whether or not they're effective.